Good morning and welcome to Sports Interview with Anne Liguori on this beautiful Saturday morning, June 9, 2018. How are we doing this morning? So glad you can join me where I am every Saturday morning from 9 to 10 Eastern Standard Time, and you can hear us from anywhere on the planet online at 883wppb.org, and every show is archived on my website at annliguori.com. And the U.S. Open at Shinnecock Hills Golf Club is upon us, finally. After all this preparation, the excitement is unbelievable, and my charity golf event is behind us. And I'll talk about that for a second, because miraculously, the bad weather this past Monday cleared by about 1 o'clock, so we just delayed the start of our charity tournament by an hour, and then it was fine the rest of the day. I mean, yes, it was a little cold and a little windy, but hey, we were happy it was dry, and the Atlantic Golf Club staff did an amazing job. The course was in mid-season shape, despite all the rain we've had in the area leading up to Monday. And the staff there was incredible. The food was incredible. You know, we had a beautiful brunch. Then we teed off at 1. Then we all came in to cocktails and appetizers. And the appetizers were out of this world. I mean, we could have been just full based on how much, you know, they served regarding the appetizers. And then they served a sit-down plated dinner, which was outstanding. And I have to say, the Anne Liguori Foundation raised more money in the auction than in our 19 previous years, which will all be going to good use. Our mission is cancer research and educating young people about the importance of good nutrition and mentorship. And so a lot of not-for-profits and charities benefit from this one charity golf tournament that we have. So I can't thank everybody enough. The golfers who all came, who in literally like just downpours, it was like the rain was coming sideways for a while, and people were driving in from New Jersey. Every foursome actually showed up except one. And we had a sold out field for the 20th straight year. And it was just incredible. Our celebrities, Grant Fuhr was the sports honoree, the winner of 5 Stanley Cups. Daniel Kinberg of Brookfield Properties, he was our business honoree. Dennis Suskind, the president of Atlantic Golf Club, he's been a committee member for years, a volunteer, and he got an award. He got a Volunteer of the Year award. Jerry Williams, who's been on our committee for years, he was also honored with a volunteer award. We had Gary Valentine there, TV Hollywood actor. We had former New York Yankees catcher Rick Cerrone, John Nitti, former running back, Bo Dietl, the wild and crazy Bo Dietl, who always auctions off his dinner for eight at Rao's. Jane Hansen joined in the festivities. It was really fun. And so I can't thank all our participants, our many sponsors and donors, and the Atlantic Golf Club more. I mean, it could not have been better. I mean, yes, we could have had a gorgeous day like today, but, you know, it was divine intervention as we all prayed all weekend that we'd be able to get the tournament in, and we did. So that was really, really satisfying. But anyway, now we move on to the U.S. Open, and players have been in and out the last couple of weeks playing the course, their caddies taking notes and walking the fairways. Tiger's yacht has been at the Montauk Yacht Club. The only question I have is, will they move this yacht closer to Shinnecock when the tournament starts? Because that's quite still a drive from Montauk to Southampton. But of course, you know, you could do the helicopter, which I'm sure he may do. I mean, wouldn't you? The transport. We'll see what his transport will be. But the weather actually looked really good most of the week. Monday and Tuesday, sunny in the mid-60s. Wednesday and Thursday, partly cloudy. Rain is predicted for now for Friday, and then bright sunshine for next Saturday for the third round, and then partly cloudy but dry on Sunday for the final round. That's June 17. So mild temperatures predicted, not much rain except perhaps on Friday. But you know, we've had so much rain leading up to this week that the course is somewhat soft at this point. Based on the mild forecast, I think the course is going to be quite manageable for these pros. You know, they have to be really accurate off the tee, keep it out of that rough. The rough is going to be brutal. And I don't think we're going to see the greens overly slick and quick because we just haven't had that heat and dryness. And so I think a score under par is going to win. And we're going to talk to renowned artist Lee
Wybransky.
Well, I just wanted to make sure I pronounced that right. Thank you very much, Lee, for coming into the studio now that I made you blush in a second. But and I want to get your take on, you know, what you think of the golf course. You've painted it and what you think of, you know, the field. But anyway, 4 or 5 under, maybe a good prediction. So anyway, local qualifying for the Open was conducted at 112 sites throughout the country between April 30th and May 17th. Sectional qualifying played over 36 holes. That was conducted internationally and at 10 U.S. sites this past Monday, June 4. So we're down to 156 golfers who will start on Thursday and Friday. And then the cut after the first two rounds will be the low 60 scores and ties. Brooks Koepka is the defending champ. His 72-hole total was 16 under last year at Erin Hills. That was 16 under. Crazy. That's not going to happen this weekend, next weekend. That's pretty much the lowdown as we enter the U.S. Open. Now, the FedEx St. Jude Classic's going on right now in Memphis, Tennessee. Dustin Johnson, he moved into the top spot on the leaderboard after carding a 7 under 63. Now, if he wins on Sunday, he would regain the number one ranking in the world entering the U.S. Open next week. So victory would vault him back to number one in the official world golf rankings a month after he lost the top spot to Justin Thomas. So anyway, and I want to tell you about two other sports stories going on. Well, of course, the Golden State Warriors sweeping the Cleveland Cavaliers 108-85 last night to win their third title in 4 years. Kevin Durant, 20 points, 12 rebounds, 10 assists after his personal best 43 points in Game 3. Stephen Curry had a game-high 37 points. They literally blew the game open in the third quarter, 25-13, led by 20 points entering the fourth quarter. And now we wait to see what LeBron James will do. Where will he go? What will he do to combat the dynasty of the Warriors? And being originally from Cleveland, I am sad that he most likely will leave town. So that's not good for Cleveland because he's done so much to for Cleveland and for the Cleveland fans. But he wants to go where he can win and not be the lone superstar. Well, he's such a superstar, that's hard. It's going to be interesting to see where he ends up. And finally, the French Open, top seed Simona Halep of Romania is taking on 10th seed American Sloane Stephens in the final, which is going on right now. Halep was runner-up in Paris in 2014 and 2017 and at the Australian Open in January. Stevens won the U.S. Open title last year against Madison Keys, the fellow American, so it should be a very hotly contested women's final. So that's going on. They're probably just getting on the court right now and starting to warm up. All right, this morning, renowned golf artist Lee Wybransky will be joining us. Lee's the artist who created the U.S. Open poster of Shinnecock. It's his 11th straight year that Lee has designed this U.S. Open poster. Tonight, there will be an artist reception starting at 7 at the Southampton Cultural Center. The exhibition started a couple days ago, and it goes through June 30th. And Lee is showing a collection of his original artwork of some of the greatest courses and championships of the game. So we're going to visit with Lee in the first half of the show. He's nice enough to have found us this morning to come in. And in the second half of the show, Jeff Benedict, co-author of the book Tiger Woods, will join us. Jeff is a New York Times best-selling author, a special feature writer for Sports Illustrated, and a TV and film producer. He has written 15 books, and together with Armen Katayan, he co-wrote What I feel is really the most definitive book ever on Tiger Woods. Over a three-year period, they conducted more than 400 interviews with over 250 people from every corner of Tiger's life, and they did not leave any stones uncovered. For the better part of two decades, Tiger was the most famous athlete on the planet, and yet, so little was known about his life and world because he and his people were able to keep most of it private. I mean, I've been covering Tiger for years, and you just couldn't get anything out of him from an interview standpoint, nor from the people surrounding him. So I can't wait to talk to Jeff Benedict about their book, Tiger Woods. So we'll hear from Jeff in the second half of the show. Sports Interview with Ann LaGore is brought to you by Peak Vision Sunglasses. Zero distortion, patented dual zone lens technology. Learn more at peakvision.com. And by Dune Jewelry and the new Hamptons Robe Collection. Savor the memories with sand from your favorite beach or spot in timeless pieces for men and women. DuneJewelry.com and available at Hilltwist Department Store right here in Southampton.
Listen to Media Mavens to hear sassy, sparkling repartee between the East End's most knowledgeable news hounds.
Listen to the Media Mavens because we've got the inside scoop on what's happening on both forks. You don't want to miss a minute.
Tune into the Media Mavens to hear from the East End's best journalists.
The Media Mavens, everything you need to know about the East End and beyond. Friday mornings at 9, Saturdays at noon on WPPB, Long Island's only NPR station.
WPPB is working for you on the air and on our website. WPPB has an amazing community calendar on our site. Just go to 883wppb.org to the community calendar tab and tell us about your activity or event. It's free, easy, and fast. WPPB is the voice of the community, 365 days a year, 7 days a week on the air and online. Spread the word about your community events. Go to 883wppb.org.
This shit, that ice cold Michelle fight for that white gold. This one for them hood girls, them good girls, straight masterpieces. Stylin', wildin', living it up in the city. Got Chuck's on with Saint Laurent.
Welcome back to Sports Interview with Ann LaGore on this gorgeous Saturday morning. I'm so glad you're listening. And the U.S. Open is upon us, and it's just a crazy, exciting week. And I'm so delighted to have Lee Rybranski in the studio. Lee Rybranski, just a renowned golf artist, showing a collection of his original artwork all month long at the Southampton Cultural Center right here in Southampton. And boy, this U.S. Open poster from a painting, an original, obviously, you did. It's just gorgeous. I love your work. Lee, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann. Great to be here.
It's fun to always see you in the U.S. Open merchandising tent because you're always busy signing your paintings and your posters. And, you know, I run into you everywhere. I mean, I've been covering the U.S. Open for a long time. How many of these have you done? You said 11?
Actually, this is number 12.
Yeah.
So we can put out a calendar now.
Exactly. Tell me a little bit about your background. You're originally from Philadelphia. You moved out west. How did you get started painting?
I was one of those kids who was always drawing and painting, you know, as long as I can remember. 12 years at Catholic school did not give me any artistic training, so it was always something I just did for fun. And then when it came time for university, I decided to pursue art. I've been hearing for years that it was a great talent of mine, so I decided to give it a run. And that's when I kind of jumped in with both feet. And then after college, I moved into the city of Philadelphia and began my career as a commercial artist. And probably 2 years or so after that is when I began working in golf. My first commission in the game of golf came from the Winged Foot Golf Club.
Wow.
And that certainly helped open a lot of doors. Within a few months of that, I was well on my way.
So have you golfed? Before that, were you a golfer
then,
at all?
I had no great interest in the game. You know, I've always been kind of skinny and nearsighted, so I was a terrible caddy at 13, and I caddied for one summer and didn't
do
very well.
Caddy?
Whitford Country Club.
Don't tell me, Marion. I'll be very upset.
Oh, no. No. I would have had the common sense to stick around there.
So you were 13 as a caddy, and then did you kind of play a little bit or no?
I played a couple of times as a teenager, but not with any seriousness at all.
Right.
I just, didn't have any great interest in it. And then once I began to work in the game professionally as an artist, I began to receive invitations to play some of these places. And I thought, maybe I should check this out. I don't like to miss out on a perk. and I also obviously thought that playing the game might help inform the work. Once it became clear that this was going to be a real career path for a while, I checked it out, and I promptly was bitten by the bug like a lot of people.
And sure, and then you were playing these courses that you were painting. Or was it, did you play them first and then paint it? Did you, before I cover a major, I feel most prepared, obviously, if I can play the course, obviously a few times, but you don't have that opportunity in many cases, but at least once before I start reporting on it and covering the tournament. Do you feel the same way? Like you should really play the course first before you paint it, or no, it doesn't have any...
I might make that pitch, now and then, but I honestly feel that I really get into the course. I walk it extensively with a camera and a sketchbook.
Right.
And I typically spend the better part of a day or two, depending on the project. I love playing great courses, of course, but I find that when I'm playing, I tend to start to care about my game more than the golf course.
Right.
And I'm not as observant as I am with a camera and a sketchbook in my hand.
So your research is walking and taking notes, obviously. Yeah. And so what are you looking for when you do those walks?
Typically, I am looking for ways to present something that is familiar in a new way. Many of the great courses that the golfing public knows, they know certain things. At Oakmont, they know the church pews.
Sure.
At Pebble Beach, Pebble Beach has a wealth of known views, but everyone knows number 7 at Pebble. So typically what I'm trying to do with my artwork, and especially with the posters, is find something that everyone recognizes so that it touches a nerve with people. But, my artistic vanity dictates that I present this in a new way. You can't just do another picture of number 7 at Pebble without changing something up about it. So I'm usually trying to find different looks of familiar subjects.
Sure. So I'm looking at the U.S. Open poster for this year, Shinnecock Hills. It's the par 5, 16th. And you see your angle is right before, the numerous bunkers on the left as you're heading toward the green. So did that take a while for you to decide, where you're going to kind of situate yourself to paint, or how did you decide, this position?
Yeah, the wonderfully benefit of digital photography, I do a lot of photography. I do paint from life and sketch a little bit when I'm on these field trips. But typically, especially if I'm on a tight schedule, I just shoot anything and everything that I think is going to be viable option. So for this view, we had kind of determined, myself and the USGA, that some view of 16 and the clubhouse was what we were going to do. So I basically just moved subtly around from, I take a few steps left, a few steps right. I work off of a ladder now and then, so I might take it, from the top of the ladder or halfway up the ladder, just to try and find that perfect look where everything in the foreground and everything in the middle ground and everything in the background all line up together in the most harmonious composition possible.
Right. So you're now not sitting there painting this. You're taking digital photos. And how many would you take of this particular scene?
I must have taken, 300 photos of just the 16th.
Really?
Sometimes I'll be shooting different parts of the picture. Like if I happen to get, I didn't have great weather when I was there. It was a fairly overcast day, but there were a few moments where I got, nice skies. So,
sure.
You grab those pictures of the sky and with a little bit of better light on the clubhouse.
Right.
And then, most of the variations have to do really with the bunkers. As you said, there's many, many bunkers there. So I was just moving little bits in either direction, trying to find a composition where the bunkers just sort of laid out nicely in the foreground.
Right, and you have a little bit of light in the background. You have the cloud cover. It's brilliant. The lighting is just so crucial to any artist's work, right? And I guess you decide... you can take some liberties with the lighting, or is
I take a lot of artistic license with the picture. In fact, this year I really typically the way I, you know, like to think about the U.S. Open posters is how the course would look on an idyllic Sunday afternoon at the championship. So a lot of the times I have puffy white clouds or clear blue skies. And with Shinnecock, I wanted to try and create something a little bit more evocative, a little bit, not moody, but, you know, just a little bit more atmosphere. So I went towards a more of a early evening, late afternoon,
sure.
Well, sort of an early evening, the beginning of sunset
kind of a feel. Best time to play.
My favorite time to play, for sure.
With the lighting. And, of course, now the fescue wasn't quite as high as we're going to see it this week. But when did you actually take this picture?
I was here last August.
Okay.
I had the good fortune of the superintendent there, John Jennings.
Sure.
The genius John Jennings is a very gracious fella. I had known him from earlier in both of our careers, and he offered to put me up and show me around the course. So I was here last August, and he spent half a day touring me around.
Nice.
And then I spent another probably day on my own. So that was when all the field work was done.
Right. So you go home with all these digital photos, and then how long is it? Well, you did it in August. So how long does it take you to actually create this?
The process works. I'll typically work up three different concepts for the USGA. They'll select one that we decide to proceed with. And then we do a few tweaks back and forth, you know, putting the logo here, putting the logo there. A lot of attention goes to the fonts, selecting fonts and the color of the type, so that the font color and style enhance, hopefully, the imagery.
Right.
So we do a lot of back and forth online, so to speak. All the
right.
preliminary work is done as digital drawings. And then once I get final approval on the layout, I begin the actual painting. And that typically takes about 50 to 60 hours, depending on size and
really?
Detail.
So now you do three different, you give them three different options, or is it, are they all different from, you know, are they on this one hole, or do you do like three different holes, or?
Typically three different holes.
Really?
I try not to have, you try not to repeat anything about it, you know, just to give them three very different directions.
Right.
So it makes it an easier decision-making process.
Interesting.
In the case of Shinnecock, I think one of the other ones that I liked was a view from 18 fairway, or between 18 and 1, because we definitely wanted to showcase the clubhouse.
Because sure.
although this golf course is arguably, you know, the best golf course in the country,
sure.
According to especially some of the caddies and members
yeah.
over there. Everyone, regardless, knows the clubhouse. So I focused on the clubhouse with two of the three options. And the second option that focused on the clubhouse was taken from the bottom of the swale that leads up to the clubhouse between 1 and 18.
Right. I mean, it's an iconic clubhouse, obviously. It was built back in 1892. It's the oldest incorporated golf club in America. And, you know, when you're talking about Shinnecock, the golf clubhouse is so much a part of it. You have to have that, obviously,
yeah.
in the paintings. So so interesting. So you did this one on 16. You said you did another one on 18?
A little between 18 and 1.
With the clubhouse up on, obviously, it was higher, highly mm-hmm. elevated from there. And then what was your other one? Do you remember?
It might have been 10. I think it was from the bottom of 10. Again, now I'm thinking about looking up towards the clubhouse from
the green.
The completely opposite
right.
side of the clubhouse.
Oh, interesting. So. Interesting. So now do you go ahead and paint those?
No,
you don't. You only paint the one.
The final selection.
So the final selection is this poster, this one on the par 5 16th, and you can see it tonight, right? Talk a little bit about what we can all expect when we head to the reception at the Southampton Cultural Center tonight at, what, 7 o'clock?
7 o'clock tonight. I'm just thrilled about this. I'm kind of thinking about it as a career, a mid-career retrospective. I've been doing this work for about 20 years now. And a lot of the work, being commercial in nature, you know, my product is typically the reproductions. So while I do sell the originals, I typically offer the originals, especially for the major championships, to either the host club or the champions. And a lot of illustrious players own my work. I do end up also retaining a lot of the original work because, you know, once the project is over and the posters are delivered, I don't actively, beyond the original or beyond the winners and the host club, I don't really actively try and sell these pieces. I've always kind of thought of them as my retirement. So I end up retaining a lot of original work
that
never really sees, the light of day or might sit in my drawers for quite some time. So with I was introduced to the Southampton Cultural Center last August when I was out here, and they had expressed an interest in hosting an exhibit, and I thought, you know, this audience, the Hamptons is certainly, you know, an art appreciative community, and I think this area is just going to be golf crazy for the month of June. So it seemed like an ideal opportunity to share my work and let people have a look at some of the things that I'm especially proud of.
So you also have, let's see, did you do the Shinnecock in 2004, or was that too early?
That was actually the first U.S. Open that I was professionally involved with,
right.
But we did not create artwork for that that U.S. Open. We have worked since 2004. We have worked with the USGA as logo designers for their championships.
Right. So you also do the logos, and which have this real Art Deco look to it. And you say that era has influenced your work greatly.
Yeah, the 20s and 30s is probably my biggest inspiration, particularly with the poster design. Many countries had just a wonderful tradition at that time. In the UK, you had the British Railway posters. Here in the States, you had the famous WPA and National Park posters. Everyone knows the lovely travel posters from France and Monte Carlo and Italy at that
sure,
same time.
I love that.
So there was just a real golden age of poster design at that time, and I take a lot of inspiration from that.
Honestly, that's what attracted me, I think, originally to the work, is the Art Deco quality of your work. And now I have so many of your posters from these U.S. Opens.
Thank
I have
you.
No more wall space. So what's the
we
woman to do?
We started making them smaller just for that reason.
I know. And now I'm buying the smaller ones because I can't go with not getting one from my memory of covering these U.S. Opens. And I just love your work. So now I'm trying, you know, they're going into other rooms of the house, which, you know, after a while, it's just like overload of anything on the wall. But it's really good stuff. So at this exhibition, you have other work as well. Can you talk about what else we can see?
Sure. Well, in my career, I did a lot of work for private clubs. So one of my early paintings, several small watercolor paintings of private clubs are there. There's a lovely piece of the Atlantic Golf Club, which was my second client in golf.
You told me you did only your second.
My second client.
Atlantic Golf Club in Bridgehampton.
Yeah, it was.
And you said it's there.
There's a small picture there, and. Let's see. I'm fortunate now to work with really, you know, many of the major championships. So there's examples of work that I've done for the Open Championship overseas. Mm. There's work I've done for the PGA Championship. The original painting that I did for the last Ryder Cup at Hazeltine National is there, as well as several USGA projects, including this year's U.S. Open original, 2014 at Pinehurst. And then some of the paintings I've done for other championships that the USGA hosts, such as the Women's Open and the Senior Open.
So would you say your work now is full-time golf and has been?
It virtually has been
like.
for most of the time. This year we've branched out a little bit. I did the poster for the NBA All-Star Game this year.
Okay.
We did a poster for the spring meet, the Thoroughbred Racing at Keeneland in Lexington. And also the Miami Open Tennis Tournament. But those are more the exception to the rule. Golf really has kept me very busy for the last 10, 15 years. So.
Have you done the poster for this year's Ryder Cup in Paris?
It's in production.
I'm
working on it right now. I'm very excited. I really didn't think, given that, you know, the French poster tradition, I was not expecting. I put my name in the hat early. You know, I love Paris, and I was thrilled for the opportunity. But I didn't think that we would get it just because I didn't think they'd go with an American artist. But I think my reputation in the game has, you know, afforded me a leg up. And I'm doing two pieces for the Ryder Cup, a limited edition print and then the official poster.
Right.
So
especially because they have that artist. What is his name? Hervé? Do you know who I'm talking about? Who designed the... He does, you know, he does more sculpture.
Ah.
He designs like he did the tees, and he does kind of real contemporary sculptures. I saw him at the PGA show, and a very talented guy, but I don't think he certainly does different work than what you're doing. But I would also think your Art Deco influence perhaps also was attractive to them, the Parisians.
You know, they're doing the poster that we're working on. They've selected a very different look, which I'm thrilled with. In addition to the championships and the more traditional landscape paintings that I've done. Over at the exhibit today, you can see a series of abstract works. I did a series of six abstractions, which are acrylic paintings on panels, which are golf holes, you know, viewed from above and abstracted with an emphasis on bold compositions, simple colors, and striking textures. Ooh. And I'm thrilled, actually, the USGA just acquired several of these paintings for their collection. They're very atypical to my portfolio. They're very different than what I would normally do, but I really am attracted to, you know, to this direction. It's nice artistically to vary as much as you can. I mean, you tend to get known for a certain look, and you need to plow that field. But it's also nice to be able to strike off in a different direction now and then. Anyway, the Ryder Cup poster is going to be something a little bit more similar to those. It's actually going to be a slightly abstracted aerial view, rendered most likely in acrylic. Wow, so it'll be very different than what
I've done. I'm really excited. I can't
wait
to see it.
Yeah, it's a neat opportunity to do
something
different.
And you'll be
there
as well. So you go to these places in advance, obviously, to do your prep work, and then you go back during the actual. So you're always on the road.
It's a lot of travel time. And travel's not easy from Flagstaff, Arizona. There's nothing very close, but it's a lot of travel time.
This is an artist mecca on the east end of Long Island because of the light, you know, in certain times of the year. It's just, you usually have to move out east here.
Well,
if I
sell a few of these paintings tonight, maybe I could afford to live out here.
So tonight's the reception at 7 p.m. at the Southampton Cultural Center. You're going to see a lot of variety from your work through the years. I can't wait to be there, Lee. I'm just so impressed with what you've done here, your whole, you know, collection. And if you weren't doing this kind of work, what would you do you think? Throwing this question at you from left field.
I don't know. I mean, one of the things that I'm keenly aware of is I feel like I love working with my hands. So whatever else I would be doing, I would imagine it would be something that involved that, where that was a part of what I do. I'm not really I love the networking and the sales side of what we do. I'm the principal person that's procuring new projects and
right.
All that is a lot of fun, but I like working with my hands, so I'm not sure what I would do. I mean, I once at one point thought maybe a surgeon. I had a few surgeries early in my life, and I had a great doctor,
right.
And I admired him greatly, and I thought at one period of time that might be something that would attract me and fit my skill set, but it didn't have as much of the creative side of things.
I bet
obviously.
You're a good putter.
My short game is certainly the strength of my game.
Your short game has to be good, as you say, with your precision and your talents. Well, thank you so much for coming in, Lee Wybransky, and this exhibition's going on tonight and through the rest of June at the Southampton Cultural Center. I can't wait to see the rest of your work.
Well, please do stop in. A lot of the paintings are available, including this year's original, but mainly the exhibition is to get eyeballs on work that I'm very, very proud of. And I'd love to hear from people, anyone who wants to reach out via social media. I'd love to hear some feedback to the show, and it should be a wonderful night. So I'm looking forward to seeing you there, Ann. Thank you.
All the best. And I look forward to seeing you out at the Open and at the Ryder Cup and the PGA, everywhere you go. Continued success, Lee.
Thanks so much
for coming in. All right, we're going to take a quick break and talk to Jeff Benedict, who co-wrote the definitive book on the one and only Tiger Woods. So stay where you are. We'll talk to him in a few minutes. First, let me tell you that Sports Interview with Ann LaGoria is brought to you in part by Peak Vision Sunglasses, Zero Distortion, patented dual zone lens technology, peakvision.com, and by Dune Jewelry and the new Hamptons Rope Collection. Savor the memories with sand from your favorite beach or spot and timeless pieces for men and women. DuneJewelry.com and available at Hildreth's department store right here in Southampton.
WPPB is working for you on the air and on our website. WPPB has an amazing community calendar on our site. Just go to 883wppb.org to the community calendar tab and tell us about your activity or event. It's free, easy, and fast. WPPB is the voice of the community, 365 days a year, 7 days a week on the air and online. Spread the word about your community events. Go to 883WPPB.org.
It's back. The Eclectic Cafe, our Sonic Gumbo. One-of-a-kind mix of music and conversations, music of all styles, classics, contemporary, what's trending in today's music world, and keeping up with what's happening on the East End. You need a guide? You got it. I'm Bonnie Grice. Join me weekday mornings 9 to noon for the Eclectic Cafe on WPPB, Long Island's only NPR station.
This is John Landis of Bayburger in Sag Harbor, inviting you to join us at the Jam Session here on WPPB on Wednesday nights at 7 for a great hour of jazz recorded live at Bayburger. And please come out and experience the Jam Session live at Bayburger on Thursday night starting at 7 for a true jazz jam Hampton style. Meanwhile, keep your dial tuned to WPPB 88.3 FM Southampton, New York for the best in local public radio.
Welcome back to Sports Interview with Ann Liguori. Glad you can join me on this gorgeous Saturday morning. You can hear us from anywhere on the planet by going online at 883WPPB.org. And each show is archived at AnnLiguori.com. And there are various podcasts out there that also have the show. So you can hear the show really any way, anywhere. And we go from art to Tiger Woods, and I guess that's a good transition because he is an artist and a genius in many ways. And joining me now is another artist, a best-selling author, a co-author of the book called Tiger Woods. Jeff Benedict joins me, and his co-author is Armand Katayan. Jeff, thanks so much for taking time out to be on the show this morning. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Just a side note, Armin and I used to live in the same building in Manhattan, so I've known him for years.
Oh, wow. I know that building. I've been there.
Exactly. It was a great spot before I moved out to the East End of Long Island full time. And I had introduced you earlier in the show as a New York Times bestselling author, a special features writer for Sports Illustrated, TV and film producer. You've written 15 books. And together with Armin, you have co-written what I feel is really the most definitive book on Tiger Woods. I've covered Tiger Woods' career from the very start. I don't think I've missed one of his major titles, all 14 of them, as a reporter for CBS Sports Radio Network and WFAN. And I don't think anybody has really, there hasn't been a book on Tiger written like this. And for good reason. He just, you know, won't talk to anybody. And he's, you know, he surrounds himself with guys who protect him. Yet over a 3-year period, you and Armin conducted more than 400 interviews with over 250 people from every corner of Tiger's life. So congratulations on such a incredible effort of research, which just must have been, how would you describe it, Jeff? What a couple years, right?
Yeah, I guess before I answer that, I just would say that I thoroughly enjoyed listening to you over the years on FAN. I was a longtime listener growing up here and living in Connecticut. So
Thank you. I appreciate
you did a wonderful
that.
Job there. It was a tremendous amount of research. And it's interesting because I was having a discussion the other day with our publisher. And he was talking about the debate that goes on, like, on a book like this, is it better to have an expert who's lived in the golf world and his or her whole life and is like a, you know, has followed Tiger forever, or to have a biographer who's a novice, who's coming at this with, you know, is not an insider and is sort of coming into foreign territory. And in this instance, we actually had a little bit of both. Armin is a golfer and belongs to a country club and at Brooklawn in Connecticut, and he's followed the sport for a long, long time, and he's actually even covered Tiger to some extent. I, on the other hand, had never played golf in my life and had never been to a PGA tournament. And I certainly knew who Tiger Woods was, but it wasn't like I closely followed his career. So we were coming at it from two very different vantage points. And my interest level was, I still remember the first time I watched Tiger Woods play, right after we started working on this book. I went to one of his tournaments, and it's my first time, so I literally don't even know, like, what I'm doing. I'm wandering around the golf course, and anybody who would have been watching me would have thought, this guy looks lost, like he's in a foreign world. And I think golf is, you know, it is its own world to a certain extent. It has its own language. It has its own terminology.
It definitely does, right.
And so for me, the first time I went to watch him play, I wasn't that interested in watching him swing or putt. I was watching things that were interesting to me as a person. I wanted to see, you know, what is it like when he walks out of the locker room and first comes into public view? And I was watching things like that, like how he walks through the tunnel of people that are there gawking at him. What he does on the practice screen when he has, you know, 45 minutes to get ready, and there's spectators around him, and he's got one person with him, and he's warming up. And, you know, how does he interact with fans when he's in between holes and stuff like that? And that, so from the beginning, you know, we were trying to draw a really intimate portrait of, you know, who is Tiger Woods? That was our first question. Who is he? And number two, what is the price or the cost of genius? And those were our two guiding questions throughout this whole book. We knew we weren't going to teach anybody anything about how great of a golfer is. Everybody already knows that. And so we were trying to get into the things that people don't know about, which is really his upbringing and how was he really raised and what were the personal familial experiences that he had. That's why we went to people like his kindergarten teacher, his first grade teacher, his principal, his first girlfriend, you know, a girl that was a second girl that was like his sister that no one had ever interviewed before. Those were the people we tried to live with through the different periods of his life who could tell us things that had never been told before.
Absolutely. And did you have to focus on this for those 3 years? Did you have to quit everything else you were doing? Because it just seems like the in-depth work almost forced you to have to do that, all the research. And
yeah, it was definitely full immersion for both of us. You know, obviously there were some things that each of us did in other areas. Like I was finishing Steve Young's autobiography when we started working on Tiger. And so there was some overlap between me writing Steve Young's book and researching Tiger's. And that was actually a really interesting juxtaposition for me because sure. Steve and Tiger are incredibly different guys, except they do share some commonality in terms of their drive and their determination and, you know, expertise in their fields and stuff like that. But so that was, and Armin had a project or two that he was wrapping up as well. But other than that, it was pretty much full immersion.
And yet, as much as you tried, you couldn't get an interview with Tiger, and his people obviously were not cooperating. And then you hear the quotes from, you know, the agent saying it's hard to imagine that two guys who have never met or spoken to Tiger can legitimately guess what he or his family were thinking. What were your reactions to their reaction?
Well, our reaction to their reaction was, you know, not much, because it was, we predicted that a year before the book even was out, I remember us having a conversation one day saying, you know, when this comes out, here's what's going to happen. Steinberg's going to read it in Glenn Greenspan, and they'll find a couple of errors. Like, you know, I think we mentioned probably 200 different golf tournaments in the book, or maybe more, you know, and we misnamed one of them. And, you know, mistakes like that are inevitable. There was a typographical error where Tiger's coach at Stanford, we misspelled his name, which, you know, it happens. And it's not like we didn't interview Wally. I did those interviews myself. But we knew that in a book like that, those things happen, and they will seize on those, and then they'll put out a statement that's something along the lines of, if you can't get the name of a golf tournament right, you shouldn't trust anything else they write. And it's an old playbook, and we knew it was coming, and it came. But that's sort of not, there's not much news in that. The more disappointing thing, I think, for us was that we never had the opportunity to have a conversation with Tiger Woods. And I say conversation, not interview, because we first requested that. We didn't request an interview. We requested an opportunity just to meet and to talk. And I think we were never counting on an interview with Tiger Woods. We assumed we would not get that.
Mm-hmm.
Which, by the way, with a biography is fine. Most biographers never get to meet their subjects because most biographies are written on people who have passed away. So it's not unusual for a book like this to not get to interview, but we made an effort. We knew we probably wouldn't get a yes, but it was disappointing that we couldn't even, that Glenn and Steinberg wouldn't even allow us to have a conversation with him. I think that's unfortunate because our approach was a sympathetic and an empathetic one. We weren't trying to take Tiger down a peg.
Right. It's very obvious that you're very fair to him.
Yeah, no, I mean, we had no reason not to be.
Right.
I mean, I think they assumed that our agenda was to embarrass him or take him down, when quite the contrary, our agenda was to explain why this guy is the greatest golfer who's ever lived.
Right.
And we describe him as a Shakespearean figure, and we use the word genius, and we don't use it lightly. We describe him early on in the book as a prodigy. We describe him later in the book as a genius because he evolved from a prodigy to a genius. Most prodigies never become geniuses. You know, you can go to the Juilliard School and see a whole classroom full of prodigies, but very few of whom will evolve into geniuses. And you can find geniuses in art, in music, in all kinds of fields. Tiger is an artist, a genius who happens to be a golfer. But he can do things with a club and balls that no one's ever done before and may never, ever do again.
My guest is Jeff Benedict, co-author with Ara Mahkatayan of the book called Tiger Woods. And of all the revelations that you uncovered through this extensive research in the book, Jeff, what was the most shocking to you?
I don't think I could name one. There were lots of things that for me were just confounding. One of the most poignant interviews that I did in this process was we found a girl who Tiger had a wonderful relationship with from the time she was 15, and he had just turned pro. So it's right after he's left Stanford. He's moved to Isleworth in Florida, and he meets a girl there that's, you know, 15 or so years old, and they become like brother and sister. And actually, that relationship stays like that through his all through his marriage to Elin. It's a wonderful relationship, and she loved him like a brother, and I think he treated her similarly like a sister. It's a great thing, and I did numerous interviews with her because they were so illuminating. I think we thought we could learn so much more from a woman like her than from a woman who might have slept with Tiger at some point. You know, like, what could she really teach us about Tiger? Whereas this girl could teach us a lot, and one of the things she said to me was, she said, I remember when I was a teenager and I would, you know, we would go to the movies or go to get pizza in Orlando. And it was so hard that we couldn't even go into a parking garage without the woman working in the parking booth going crazy when she realized Tiger Woods was coming through the garage. And she said it just made it awkward to go anywhere in public. And so we ended up spending a lot of time, you know, not in public, like at home and places like that in the neighborhood. But she said, later on in life, he said to me one time how his favorite place to be on the planet, other than between the ropes, is at the bottom of the ocean. And the reason for that is because there are no people there. There are only fish.
Sure.
And they don't want anything from me.
Hmm.
And, you know, Tiger became a great scuba diver. He's a great diver.
Right.
And
he does a lot of spearfishing and he finds solace in the ocean and in the calm and you know, just the solitude of underwater.
The deep sea. And so we went, I tracked down his scuba diving instructor. I wanted to find the guy who taught him to dive, which I knew he learned to dive not long after he became a pro, because when he got to Isleworth, that's when he met the instructor and he started diving in Florida. And we found that guy. He's retired now, but still living, and did a great interview with him. And he explained the process of teaching Tiger to dive. And first of all, he said he was, you know, perhaps the best student he'd ever had. He said he was an unbelievably fast learner. He said the other thing about it was not long after learning to scuba dive, Tiger wanted to start cave diving. And cave diving is a completely different thing than scuba diving. You're going into these deep, dark places beneath the, you know, the earth. And it's actually very dangerous. I mean, you've got to be super skilled to do it. And there are major insurance risks for a guy like Tiger Woods to be cave diving, but the guy was talking about how he was fearless. He loved to go into those dark places. And
talk about an escape, right? That's like the ultimate escape from the world.
It's so fascinating when you think about him in those ways. And that's what I mean about not being as interested in watching him swing or putt for me. I was interested in, and Armin was too. I mean, we were interested in looking at him from perspectives that he hadn't been viewed
from
before.
Right, he definitely brought a fresh perspective to, you know, to this whole project. Whatever happened to that girl, by the way? His best friend?
She's still around. She's great.
But
she's
does he still keep in touch with her or no?
The last time he communicated with her was a few hours before he crashed his car in 2009.
Really?
Yeah.
What did he say to her?
Happy Thanksgiving.
Huh. And that's it? Then she's not heard from him since?
She has not heard from him since.
Wow. I have so many questions for you. And again, you wrote in the book, no question has hovered over Tiger more than whether he used performance-enhancing drugs. And Tiger has denied this. And he admitted that Dr. Galea, is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah,
Dr.
Yep.
Galea came to his house. Jeff, you do a whole chapter on this, but let me just ask you, in your own opinion, do you feel he has used performance-enhancing drugs? What's your opinion on that?
I don't think he has. And it's not, I don't say that with any reservation. Mostly Armin, so we divided labor up on reporting. There were areas that I did and areas that he did. Armin, PEDs was an area that Armin spent an incredible amount of time researching. I mean, the guy was just dogged. And at the end of the day, I was persuaded that he has not. I think he's had a cloud over him for a long time about PEDs. I understand why people are suspicious. And I think some of that within the golf community, some of that stemmed from jealousy. Some of that stemmed from assumption. I think outside the golf world, there's just this cynical look at athletes who, any athlete who bulks up the way he did. But I think it takes away from and is a misunderstanding of how this guy was built and how he trained. I interviewed, you know, going back to Stanford, his golf coach at Stanford told a great story about how I think when Tiger got to Stanford, he had not lifted weights yet. That's not something he did in high school. He didn't really have access to weights in high school. But when he got to Stanford, he started lifting weights after he met Bill Walsh, who was then the football coach at Stanford. He'd left the 49ers. He'd gone back to Stanford. He was the coach there. Tiger went to see Walsh in his freshman year. He'd only been at Stanford a couple months. He went without an appointment. He went to Bill Walsh's office. This is the middle of football season. And Bill Walsh and Tiger Woods have a lot of things in common. They're both introverts. They're not really social. They're both geniuses in their own right. They hit it off immediately. Bill Walsh was enthralled with Tiger and vice versa. And Bill Walsh gave Tiger Woods a key to the weight room at Stanford. And his golf coach told me that Tiger Woods is the only athlete in the history of Stanford that had his own key to the weight room. No football player had access to the weight room like that.
Right.
And Wally told us that Tiger Woods lifted weights more than the football players did. He lived in the weight room when he wasn't practicing golf. And so this obsession with weightlifting started very early in his life. When you fast forward to when he's at the peak of his pro career on the PGA Tour, and he looks like a defensive back, and he's got the great biceps and
right.
the thick
shoulders. From a scrawny looking kid when he first started
yes.
his career to that bulked up look. Yeah, I mean, a lot of people, and you know, the crazy thing is a lot of the players also felt that he was, you know, taking.
Using.
Exactly. But you're that chapter in the book is brilliant about you know the research that went into all the doctors you interviewed, and he
yeah.
actually authorized Dr. Lindsay to disclose information about his treatment to Tiger and provide you know his medical opinion on whether Tiger used banned substances, which the doctor denies that he did. So I want to quickly move to two other questions for you before the end of the show. As close
sure.
as Tiger was, Jeff, to his father, the book says that his father is buried in an unmarked grave site. How is that possible, and what are your thoughts about that?
It was profoundly startling to us. When you talk about shocking things we learned.
Yes.
we went out to Kansas. We didn't know about that. Nobody knew about that. That's never been reported. It was completely unknown. We were just doing our due diligence as journalists, checking everything. And so we went out there to find the grave because one of the things we wanted to see was what was inscribed on it, what was on the headstone. And so we didn't go out there because we knew there was no headstone. We went out there assuming there was, naturally there's got to be, what's written on it, you know, what's it look like there, just fact-finding. And then you get out there, and, you know, Armin was the one who went to Kansas, and it's like, can't find anything. And it's almost like, how come I'm having so much trouble locating this? So you call the sexton for help. Can you help us locate the grave because we're having trouble? And the sexton's going, well, there isn't one. We're going, what? What are you talking about? There isn't. How can there not be a gravestone? Well, fortunately for us, the sexton that we called was the one who actually presided over the burial.
Really?
He dug the hole. Yeah, he dug the hole. He dug the shaft. And normally sextons are very private guys, but this guy, who is sensitive, and by the way, very thoughtful comments about Tiger and his family, he spoke, I think, from the heart, but he had a great memory, and he recalled the whole situation. And it just was that, when we discovered that, that was actually very early on in the process for us. It told us really in the beginning, wow, there's a lot here that I just think, we think people probably don't
sure.
know.
Did he
about.
Say, was Tiger there at the burial?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
He was, yeah.
He talked about this phone call that he got, you know, like 2 nights before the burial. He got this phone call really late at night. A woman called him, and she wouldn't give her name, and she said there was a burial coming and wanted him to get, you know, get ready for it. And he was asking, well, who's it for? And she wouldn't give him the name. And he's like, well, I can't help you if I don't know who I'm digging for. You know, I've got to know if they've even got a plot here in the cemetery. And she's like, well, he does have a plot. And finally, in the background, he said, I could hear a man's voice and telling the woman, just tell him who it's for. And then the woman finally said, it's for Earl Woods.
Wow.
And that's when and so he remembered that conversation vividly. And then he said, you know, 2 days later, they were there, and he dug the shaft, and Tiger came, and Coltita came, and Earl's 3 children from his first marriage camp.
I wonder if it's just an oversight that there's no, marker
no.
or whatever. But anyway,
that's not an oversight.
We need to get you back on. We're out of time. Jeff Benedict, the book is Tiger Woods. Thank you so much. You're doing a couple book signings out here. And
yes.
Real quickly.
We'll be at Brookhampton on Friday night, Armin and I together, the second night of the tournament.
Thank you so much.
I'm
sorry we're
out
of time. Lee Wybrinski, thanks so much. And Kyle Lynch, we'll talk to you next Saturday morning.